George Leeson, Rail 3.
There was this dip in the ground in which there was a large area of ground which was completely invisible to us and through which the enemy could have walked and suddenly popped up in front of us. It wouldn't have been too bad if our right flank had been held, because from our right flank you could see round this, but of course our right flank was empty because of this former commander of number four company, Overton, deserting with his men and running back to the sunken road, and no attempt being made, Fry probably as responsible as Winteringham, no attempt made to string out over there, you see. And what we should have been told, we had 8 Maxim guns, we usually only had about 5 or 6 in action at a time, because as they jammed, we sent them back to the sunken road for the armourers to work on them and send them back. But at any time we had about 5 or 6, well, 2 of them should have been taken out with a dozen or so riflemen onto that right flank to hold that, then the fascists wouldn't have broken through there. Plus the fact that also the Franco-Belge battalion further on the right, the next battalion to us on the right, they had been forced back. They had retreated and they'd gone back, I suppose, about 300 or 400 yards. And so we were an exposed advanced position. Of course, the thing is, I mean, you look back in retrospect, but after continual artillery bombardments and heavy machine gun fire all day, which makes you keep your head down all the time, all day long, when suddenly there's a complete cessation of the artillery fire and the machine guns stop from the enemy side, complete silence from the enemy side, you think, what's the enemy doing? The enemy hasn't packed up and gone home for the night because it's still broad daylight. The enemy has stopped doing that because it doesn't want to hit its own men who are advancing. And then also, just before that, about a half an hour before the seizure of the fire, we'd seen these men running round. This surprises me because they were trained soldiers for it, running down the skyline from the top of a hill position they'd held, running down the side of the hill, in which we actually mowed them down with our Maxim guns. Now, why were they running down from that hill? They were running down to get in the cover of this position to come up. You see, poor old Fry's dead now, but as a company commander, he should have sent back to Wittram and said, the enemy must be grouping in the blind spot underneath it. They have seized their bombardment. I'm afraid that there is going to be an enemy advance. What do you advise me to do? Shall I pull back to the sunken road? Shall I string out my men to the right? You see?
So then you saw the...
Yes, then there was this business with the ankle. Of course, I mean, this has been romanticised and so on since. There was no question. I mean, only a romantic could think that when the enemy is winning and advancing like that, why should, and they're foreign legionary and Moorish troops, why should they suddenly decide to come and desert and come over to our side?
So he stood up.
He stood up and he said, cease fire, don't shoot, they're coming over to us, and led them all in singing the international and standing up and giving claims for it. Of course, a lot of our lads were shot from the fact that they were standing up and not taking cover. About half the men holding that line there were shot as they came over. The rest of us just had our rifles knocked out of our hands and were surrounded. I mean, it's very good to be wise after the event, but you can sit down after the event and think of these things. And really, in fact, that company or remnants of the company were thrown away. And the 6 Maxim guns were thrown away, which were captured by the enemies there, by very serious blunders, which I'm sure wouldn't have been made afterwards.
Now, we at this stage, then, you were taken prisoner.
Yeah, George, yeah.
Then, when did your release come, actually?
Now, the main body, as I say, Goldberg and I were kept back. As hostages. Now, I think it must have been the end of May, I think, that the others were sent back. And then I was taken up. I was taken up to Irun, as I say, not going to happen to me, taken up to Irun. And there, I was taken into the office of this commandant of the frontier, Commandante Troncoso, and I met the British Vice Consul. And he said, you're being exchanged and you will be going across the frontier tomorrow and I shall meet you there tomorrow, you see. And so put down in the local lockup in Irun the next morning, wait to be taken. Well, I waited 3 months. And I never asked them anything about what has happened. I never found out what went wrong. I never did, and never will find out how it was. But obviously something had been arranged for me to go across. I don't know whether perhaps at the other end there was supposed to be an exchange of somebody coming across from the Republican side, a Frankist prisoner coming across, and it fell over. All I know was that I was taken down there and I spent 3 months never knowing what was going to happen.
So when did you eventually cross into France?
Well, eventually crossed into France in, by this time, this chap Martinson had come up, who'd been left behind in Talavera, and we eventually were taken across the frontier about the middle of September in 1937, because as we understood it from the vice consul, the arrangement had been made by then, the exchange arrangement, and then we were brought across the frontier then.
What happened to you personally after that?
Well, I came back and I wanted to go out again. And I went to see Isabel, a number of people, and I'd managed to talk quite a few of them round to the idea that I would go out again, because I wanted to go out again. And then came, first of all, Fry killed in action. Well, from Fry killed in action, they said, no, you're not going out. And then afterwards, of course, came the business of Jimmy Rutherford, and that they wouldn't allow anybody who had been prisoners, quite right, to go across again, because we were under death sentence, and what difference would one or two men make anyway? So I worked then in Spanish aid organisations, and then each nationality had one representative in Paris, and that one representative in Paris looked after both people who were going out to Spain and people who were coming back wounded for another reason. I was the British delegate, I was sent over there, and by that time no more people were going out, and I was responsible for anybody coming back, people wounded and being repatriated and making the arrangements for them to come back. Some fantastic experiences there too. You see, I had to keep travelling down to the frontier whenever anybody British was coming. And then there was a Canadian delegate, an American delegate, and we arranged it between us. And sometimes I went down there to bring across Americans or Canadians who were coming across. And first of all, it was mainly groups of wounded who come across. I remember particularly one lot of wounded came across, and when you went down in the train, there were always one or two doctors from the French-Spain Aid Committee, leading doctors who gave their services free of charge, who came down. And I remember it was in December. It was bitterly cold. It was snowing even down in the south of France. It's one of the coldest winters we've had this last winter, the Spanish War. And went down there, and these wounded came across, a large number of them, stretcher cases, other walking cases. And I always remember this, the British vice-consul, not the one from Ondé, but the British vice-consul from Paris came down, a chap with a bowler hat, who spoke terrible French, abominable French. And we got down there, and there were all nationalities. There were Germans and Italians and Poles and all sorts of people who had no country to go back to. Coming across was a big lot of wounded, only a certain number of them were British. And I got down there before him, and I saw the head of the local Popular Front Committee in Perpignan, and went down with him to, it's not Portbou, it's Cerbère, where the train was coming across. And I thought, well, when these people come across, it's, the British consul is coming. Well, now, what arrangements? They didn't have much money. We've got to give them a meal. These chaps be starving when they come across. I said, let's arrange a meal for them in the station waiting room. We said, oh, but I said, the British pay. The non-intervention committee has put funds aside to pay for the repatriation of these people. We'll get him up. We'll get him to pay. And so, as these lads came across, they all sat down to this slap-up meal. They were delighted. We had a packet of cigarettes given to each one of them like this. And I was sitting with the vice consul at the same table, this chap from the anti-fascist committee. And this vice consul, I had to keep interpreting for him, because when anybody spoke French in any speed, he couldn't follow it, you see. And then eventually the waiter came round with the bill, this enormous bill, and presented. I said, who's the prince? I said, him. And he looked and he said, what's this, Mr. Leeson? I said, this is to pay for the meal for these people. He said, no, but we're not going to pay for the meal. I said, the British government is paying for the meal. But I said, the non-interventionists. I said, you're not going to disgrace me in front of these French people by pretending the British government hasn't got money to pay for this and so on. And so eventually, grudgingly, he said, and then he said, well, of course, I should only pay for the British. These people are not all British. I said, these people have got no countries to go back to. They wouldn't get a meal back for that. And in the end, we got them to pay for the lot. And then I put a phone call through to the Daily Worker. And I had a list of all the British in there. And it was a long phone call, because, again, we'll report what's happening. And I gave the name and hometown of all these people coming across all over in long-distance call. British consul paid for that at all. Then we arranged, as they went on the train, each lad would have a couple of, you know what, French sandwiches and a bottle of beer. And the consul would pay for that. And as they were getting on the train, each were getting that, this poor forlorn chap said, I suppose I'm paying for this as well, am I, Mr. Leeson? I said, the British government is. And then when they went to get on the train, there was one young lad who was very badly wounded. And the French doctor says, this chap will never stand up to the journey in these conditions. And so I'm putting him into hospital. And so he's taken away and putting him from the hospital. Now, I forgot about that chap until months later. It was not long before the end and they'd come back. And we got a message through in Paris that there was an English lad in a hospital near Bordeaux. And so I went down there. And I found this hospital in Bordeaux, and this hospital was full. The evacuation, the war was over by then, the Spanish refugees had come, full of Spanish wounded. And among them was this British lad, who had been, he couldn't speak, and he was being feted by these Spaniards, look after yourself. They were delighted that I came for him. And so I got a railway ticket, and I took him by train, and we went by train from Bordeaux right up round to Dieppe, where I put him on the boat to England. Now, he still couldn't walk, and everywhere I carried him, and I carried him around. I remember giving him my overcoat as well, and put him on the boat where I made arrangements for him to be met at New Haven. All sorts of experiences like that we had.
How long were you in Paris?
Well, I was there from, that was September 1938 until just after the end of the war. Well, after the end of the war. And then after we'd got all of our, because I got the battalion out as well, we arranged them coming out. I told you about the Salvation Army and so on. And then after that, the flood of Spanish refugees came across from Catalonia. And all those who was, particularly the Canadian and American, because we could get funds to, and the French delegates, we appealed to the people at home to send everything they could in money and so on. And we paid regular visits down to these camps, particularly at Argelès-sur-Mer, where they were being so horribly treated by the French authorities. What I could tell you about that, they were put along the shore at Argelès. And there were taps which ran under the sand, which the sea went over, and the water was all brackish, and so one or two taps here. And they were guarded by French Moroccan soldiers. They'd been fighting against the Moors in Spain. Lots of them were wounded. The sand was blowing into their wounds. And they would play all sorts. The Moors were around them with machine gun nests like this, and swearing and cursing and beating up. And they would play all sorts of tricks. So, for instance, these starving people, a lorry would come in with these rolls of bread. And they would stop. And these people would sort of crawl their way and form a queue at the tail of the lorry, and then the lorry would drive off a few hundred yards there. So they had to drag themselves over there and so on to get the bread. And we were going down bringing food and things, and every time we went down, we smuggled a few of them out. We smuggled dozens of them out of the camp like that. And we brought things, you know, we brought things down for them. And another thing very interesting, the Germans and Austrians and Italians who couldn't go back home, and Poles and so on, we had them up in Belleville, which is a very working class district up in Paris. And they were living in shabby-looking hotels. Every so often they'd be raided by the French police, and I got pulled up with them, but I had a British passport, but I went in. They would raid about 3 o'clock in the morning, empty the hotels, take us all down to the police station. When we got down to the police station, we was kept there till about 8 o'clock, and then we'd say, well, what about some breakfast? And the French police would at least have some breakfast free of charge. And then eventually what happened regularly with these chaps, I was all right, I had a passport. These had no passport, and they were giving a refus de séjour. And the Refus de Séjour, which had their photo on, said that they were given 24 hours to remove themselves from French territory, which they couldn't do anyway. So the next time they were rounded up, they had another one of these. But the shopkeepers up in Belleville were marvellous to these chaps. We could only give them 5 francs a day as an allowance. But they lived because the shopkeepers gave them vegetables, meat, bread, everything. There was such a tremendous solidarity movement with the people around there. Otherwise, these chaps, would never have managed to live on their 5 francs a day.
The 5 francs came from where?
From the Spanish, from the French Spanish Aid Committee,
yes,
which was at Cité Paradis.
Yes.
Yeah.
What happened to these refugees ultimately?
Well, eventually, the French, when obviously the attack was going to be made by Germany, when this became obvious later on about June or July that year, the French government decided to clear out all refugees from Paris. And these people were all rounded up, taken, because I went with them to the Prefecture of Police, and they were shipped down and they were put in concentration camps down at all sorts of places down in the south of France, including Albi and so on. And there was this, Gourz was the famous one,
yeah,
there, and they were put there. And what happened to them later on, most of the camps, fortunately, were in what became the Vichy zone. And so it wasn't immediately occupied by the Germans, and lots of the Spaniards there. Now, eventually, the Spaniards and the Iberians in those camps broke out of the camps and joined the French Maquis.
Yeah.
They did join the French Maquis. It was from this that developed what led to the later of the tragedy in Hungary, because Reich and the Hungarian international brigaders who were down there, they formed an order, and they were in the Maquis and so on. When they get back to Hungary, this developed between the Moscow group and the Western exile group.
Yeah.
And from this, this idiot, this maniac, Rakashi, who accused all these people of being the Western immigration, of being fascists and collaborators and so on, though they had fought and he'd been sitting in Moscow. It was this that the persecution of international brigaders took place in Hungary and the execution of Reich, This happened as a result of this. Because these people, in fact, their lives were probably saved by the fact that the French government wasn't doing any of their welfare. They were, because they'd been in Paris, they wouldn't have survived. The fact that they were sent to these camps, which happened to be in the Vichy zone.
And those whom did not escape, in fact, were repatriated.
They would have been repatriated, and probably
some were
captured, and some. There were all sorts of funny things going on, you see. Because while they were living there, these Germans, they told me, people from the German embassy were continually coming around and finding them in cafes and trying to persuade them to go back to Germany. You see, nothing will happen to you, you'll be forgiven and so on. Living here, why live these bloody French treating you like this? A disgrace to treat Germans in this way. You come back home, everything will be forgiven. Now, some of them fell for it. And, they say, here's 100 francs, and here, go and buy yourself a good meal. Here, I'll go and buy you a new suit of clothes and so on. And there's decent chaps. And a number of them did fall for it and went back to Germany. What happened to them, I don't know. They might have been bumped off. They might not have been. They might have just been enrolled in the German army. Some of them obviously were weaker types. And some of them might have even ratted, A chap who's prepared to listen to the German embassy like that might be a disaffected element anyway, I don't know.
So in June, 1939,
yes.
your job was in fact finished?
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And is that when did you return to London?
I returned to London then, yes.
And where did you go from there, George? You couldn't get your old job back because...
No, I couldn't get my job back. I wasn't accepted into the British Armed Forces. It's so extraordinary. There's extraordinary things happened, you see. Clive Branson was accepted into the British Army. Bill Alexander was not only accepted into the British Army, Bill Alexander was sent to the officers' training school and was given the Sword of Honour as the best cadet in the passing out.
This is our Bill.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes, got the Sword of Honour and became a major in the British Army and so on.
You couldn't?
I wasn't. wasn't. I was called up. I was taken for my medical examined grade one. And I remember the officer interviewing me. He said, "Oh, with your experience, Mr. Leeson, you'd be a marvellous candidate for the commandos." I said, "Oh yes, that would suit me marvellously." You see, I said, "Or the navy." I said, "I've served in the navy, but from that time I was never called up." The word. Occasionally around London, I would be, they were stopped in the street by the police. And they would say, "Have you had your call up papers? Have you registered for?" And I would pull out my thing and show it to them. And they'd say, "God, you were interviewed, examined, so and so. Why haven't you been called up?" I'd say, "Don't ask me, ask them." And that was it. Nothing
ever. Did nothing ever happen?
No, nothing. I never called up. Never.
Did you ever inquire?
I volunteered. I wrote a letter to the Admiralty saying that I had had service in the Royal Navy, I'd been a seaman gunner, and I would like to volunteer for service. And they said, "Well, I'm afraid we can't do this. We are calling up people in rota. We have our own system. We can't accept volunteers. We call people up as and when we need them, you see." And then I wrote to the Merchant Marine saying, "We're the same thing. We are recruiting people as and when we require them. We do it through the Labour Exchange. Go to the nearest Labour Exchange."
nothing
ever happened. You see. It was extraordinary. There were a number of other brigaders like that who were never called up. There were others who were called up and thrown out. Jock Cunningham, for instance, was called up, and 3 weeks later he was thrown out. When they found his record, they threw him out of the army. Extraordinary. Sam Wild was never called up. You see, Sam Wild had been a battalion commander, but so had Bill Alexander. Bill Alexander was called up, Sam Wild wasn't.
Yeah, I wonder what the difference was. Was Bill as closely involved in left-wing politics?
Oh, yes. No difference. It was probably just the local, there were all sorts of recruiting, there was one in this part of London, mine was the one in Acton in London. There were different offices all over the country, and I suppose it was the individual in charge of that, what he decided in particular circumstances. Call up. Or else some decision had been made somewhere, keep so-and-so out, it'd be likely to be an agitator. Oh, I know another one who wasn't Ted Willis, for instance. You know Ted Willis, yes. Who's now Lord Willis? Yes. He was thrown out of the army. He hadn't been an IBer, but he was called up, put into the army, and then suddenly, at a moment's notice, thrown out, discharged like that.
Did you in fact go back to political activity during the war?
Oh yes, I did. Yes, I did. I did. I did quite a lot of organising for the Communist Party, in particularly in the northwest area of London, in the factory areas there, and and speaking on behalf of the war effort and so on, which we were doing at that time, and going around factories and so on and organising. Then after the war, I went into teaching, and the rest of my life was as a teacher.
And did you
taught Spanish and French.
How did you become a teacher?
Well, at the end of the war, there was this emergency training scheme, for people who'd been in the forces. I hadn't been in the forces, but somebody said to me, "Well, apply anyway, even though you haven't been in." So I applied, even though I hadn't been in the forces. And I found, for instance, Edward Blishen, who was a colleague of mine after, the writer and so on, he had been a pacifist during the war and so on, but he got in as well, and I managed to get in. I went up for an interview, and I remember I went up for this interview, and because I had been at a grammar school in Scotland and got my intermediate certificate, I didn't have to do any written exam and so on. All I did was an interview, but very cleverly, I got two good referees. One referee I got was Stephen Swingler, MP, who lived near us. I got him as my other one referee. And the other was Gladys Driver, headmistress, whom I know, who was mistress of school in Harrow. So probably they asked me all sorts of awkward questions at the interview, and so this and so on. How would you teach your class about Cecil Rhodes, Would you tell him he was an old imperialist and so on, all this sort of things? And I kept saying, how would you teach them this, that and the other? And in the end, I sort of flattened them. I said, as I conceive it, I would be teaching my subject in a school and not my political opinions, because my political opinions are my own private concern, and it would be completely wrong, it would be criminal of me to attempt to impose my political opinions at all. And One of the people interviewing said, "Quite right, Mr. Leeson, quite right."
Did they question your International Brigade experience?
Oh, they did, yes, they asked that. But by that time, they'd got round to it. As a matter of fact, at that time, you got increments on your salary. Now, the way you got increments on your salary, if you'd served in the armed forces, you got one increment for every year you'd been in the armed forces. Well, I had none of those. But any years of employment that you'd done in useful employment, you got one for three. So I got one for three with that. And then I put in service in Republican Spain as a soldier. And with months and months. But eventually I got a communication from County Hall, which by that time was later controlled, saying, "We have decided to grant you one-for-one increments for your service in Spain as a soldier."
And after that, I think you did suggest to me that you'd broken your links with the Communist Party.
I did, yes, in 1956. I'd had differences with the Communist Party over quite a long time. I mean, my main difference with the Communist Party was, and is, that I consider that it's rather stupid in this country, where you have an enormous labour movement, a great mass labour party, for a small section of the most militant people on the left to form themselves into a little political party which can never hope to achieve power, can never hope even to achieve representation in Parliament, that in fact you are taking out of the Labour Party and isolating from the Labour Party some of the most militant sections, and if those people were in the Labour Party, it would help to make the Labour Party far more militant. They don't need to exist. I've had the answer that, "Oh yes, but what about teaching them their Marxist scientific theory and so on?" Well, of course, Marxist scientific theory, the books, all the books on socialist theory and so on, are available to be read by anybody who wants to read them. You don't have to be a member of the Communist Party. And that was me. The final blow, of course, was Hungary, where I just would not accept the version put forward on Hungary at all, and I know very well, because we have Hungarian friends, that the version put forward by the communists is incorrect, to say the least of it. And of course, particularly the trial of Imre Nagy, who was prime minister at that time, and who was taken away to a foreign country, to Romania. And nothing more was heard of him until rumours came out that he'd been put on trial in Romania, in a foreign country, and executed by a firing squad. What for? And that Paul Malater, who had been an international brigadier in Spain, and who was accused of being a fascist and reactionary and so on, always an honest-to-goodness chap, and who was taking part in the rising against Hungary, which took place mainly because of mistakes of the Hungarian Communist Party, who had treated the people so badly that the people rose in revolt against them, not led by fascists or reactionaries at all. And that was the main thing, so my break.
That was an abrupt break.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Although, of course, it had been prepared for a long time, because for a long time I had not been active in the Communist Party at all, because I had had differences on that. And I had felt also, I had been to Russia, I'd been to China as well, and from what I saw in Russia, I was very disillusioned with what happened in Russia.
When did you go to Russia?
I went in 1952, I went right through Russia. I went to China for a conference in China in Peking, spent several months in China, and I travelled all the way through Russia, you know, in slow stages, both going there and coming back, and saw quite a bit of it. And what I saw there did disillusion me considerably. And of course, what we've had since with, I mean, I'm not accepting Solzhenitsyn, who I've got no, who I take no part at all. But I mean, the treatment, for instance, of Jews in the Soviet Union, which no one can deny, this terrible treatment of Jews, anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union, which you would never expect if you read, and the treatment of intellectual dissidents being put in mental homes. I mean, you can't dismiss them all as Solzhenitsyns and so on, and I will not accept this. I can't possibly think that a party which behaves in that way and runs a country in that way can possibly be called humanitarian, let alone socialist.
So what was your impression of China at that time?
My impression of China was very favourable. I don't know whether I'm romanticising a bit, but my profession of China was very favourable. I thought it was a tremendous... I've never seen a people so solidly behind its government, and I really think they were doing marvellous work, that the leaders had not lost contact with the masses, as they have in Russia, and that the Chinese were trying... They realised that they had come to power not by dictatorship of the proletariat and so on, by working class struggle. They had come to power as a result of a peasants' war, and that they rested themselves on the strength of the great masses of the Chinese peasantry, and that the thing to do was to lift up the peasantry, and that they would not achieve their revolution by just at a snap of the fingers changing the economic system, that they realised to achieve socialism was a long and slow process, which means changing human nature.
Yes.
And I was convinced that's what they were doing.
Yes.
And I think that is what they are doing.
But this didn't offset your view of communism sufficiently to keep you in the party.
I wouldn't, because anyway, the British Communist Party is welded to the Soviet Communist Party anyway, you see. And it was with the Soviet Communist Party that I was disagreeing in the main, and also with the Hungarian Communist Party, that the way they acted as licks, but not now, I think. But there are splits, there are differences within the communist movement, too, you see. But, I mean, basically, completely disregarding this, my feeling is, I mean, I meet here with communists, I'm very friendly with communists, I'm in the same struggle with them.